Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. The Sauter family went to sleep on Christmas Eve in 1945, expecting to wake up to a joyous Christmas morning. However, shortly after midnight, the family was awakened to the smell of smoke and the sound of fire destroying their home. Five of their children remained trapped inside, but they were never seen again. Or were they? This is True Crime Cast.
Welcome back to True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie. As always, I got John with me. John, it feels like forever since we've recorded an episode.
Man, it's been a while. Apparently, in that time, my voice has gotten deeper and more manly.
Did you hit puberty in the off season?
Finally, man. Tennessee puberty takes a long time. What, almost 30-something years now, right?
I guess. I mean, Tennessee basketball takes a long time to drop out of the top 10. Or maybe it just took a week. I don't know.
We're going to edit out the sucker punch I just gave Jamie in the nose. Yeah, I was really hoping you'd forget that we did sports updates here on True Crime Cast, but apparently you didn't. So Tennessee not doing great right now, but you know what? I'm still hopeful. I think they're still a good team. We just played a bad game against Kentucky and unfortunately went down to LSU and lost in overtime there. So, man, I still see good things on the horizon, but Kentucky, I think things look great for them right now.
Feel good, trying not to get overconfident, but things are looking great. Got to finish the SEC season strong. Got to win at Tennessee in a couple weeks. Calipari has a losing record in Thompson Bowling Arena. I don't know if you knew that.
I did, actually, and I hope it continues this Saturday. So were you planning on watching that game together? Because I'm going to bring a shank, if so.
That's something to stab me with for those of you who
have never been to prison.
Yeah. For those few of you that have never been to prison, you know who's doing better than Tennessee, John? That's True Crime Cast. We have several new Patreon members. I just want to give them a shout out. Lee upped Lee's pledge from $3 to $7, so we really appreciate that. Get on that next level where you would receive a signed photo from us. Shauna came in as a new patron. And we have a friend from Australia that we've been emailing with, discussing cases, and he's been sending us a lot of information for some research we're doing. And I'm going to try to say his name. And he came in at one of our higher levels, going to get a coffee mug, a signed picture, the whole deal, if we can figure out how to ship to Australia. That's another thing. His name is Domisco Del Barbarez.
I'm glad you had to say that and not me, mate.
I hope that's right. I really like it when we hear from our international listeners and they say things in their dialect. It makes me very happy.
Yeah. In his email, he said y'all. So I don't know that was like just a loving affirmation to us that saying y'all is okay, or if they say y'all in Australia. If they say y'all in Australia, I need to move to frickin' Australia.
Why are we still here?
Right?
Yeah.
We didn't script that, guys, though. That's just kind of weird.
He did say y'all. I was excited about that. We keep getting reviews and messages about our accents, and I guess I'm just going to have to accept that it's a real thing.
I really don't hear your accent. I'm sure you can hear mine.
My wife wears a t-shirt that says, "We don't have accents, y'all do." And I like that a lot.
That's funny.
That is good.
Every time I read those reviews, I want to say, you know what? It's taken me over 30 years to get this, and don't see it leaving me anytime soon.
What was it like 15 years ago, though?
Oh, Lord. If you're familiar with the show King of the Hill, there's a character on there named Boomhauer. Man, he talks like this. Put eight cylinder in my truck, man. Tell you what.
I love Boomhauer.
It's kind of how I sounded like. So
that's awesome. Look, guys, we've given this other podcast a shout out a couple times. We're going to give them one more. We're going to talk about a podcast called Case Closed by McMillan Publishing. It's about Erin Corwin on a hot summer day in 2014. She kissed her husband goodbye, and she went for a hike in Joshua Tree National Forest, and then she disappeared. She didn't come back. 2 months later, they found her body in an abandoned mine shaft in the desert. The investigation that resulted from that brought up old secrets, and it really rocked this small marine community where Erin had lived with her husband. Like I said, this is on a podcast called Case Closed. They're starting to wrap this season up, so I encourage you to go ahead and get started and subscribe to that and check that out. They also actually have season two that's out on Stitcher Premium if you want to listen to both of those.
Yeah, man. So, yeah, go check that out. Subscribe to it. Show them some love. We'd really much appreciate it. Want to go ahead and mention real quick, and then we'll get into the case. We're still waiting to hit 50 patron members over on Patreon. As soon as we hit 50, we're going to take questions from you all and do a question and answer session. Should be a blast. We've already told our patrons on the bonus episode to go ahead and start getting their questions to us. So we look forward to getting those. If you're not signed up on Patreon, you guys are really missing out. Before we recorded this episode we're doing right now, we recorded our bonus episode. Jamie, can you just give them a little teaser about what that episode was about?
We give some updates on old cases, which I enjoy doing, but we also have a lot of fun. We talked about a lot of crimes associated with game shows. Some of your favorite game shows you've heard of, some crazy game shows you've never seen, but a lot of crimes associated with those, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we also did a segment in that show for dumb criminal activity. We mentioned a couple of recent cases that are just phenomenally dumb, albeit funny. We keep it lighthearted over there. We don't do a lot of murder stuff. We have sometimes, but not often. Check it out. If you guys are not on Patreon, you're really missing out. It's our lowest level you can get into is $3 a month. Listen, you're going to spend that on a cup of coffee. You might as well pay $3 and listen to this stuff. I really think it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree, John. One last thing we'll ask, and we'll get into the case, and then we'll leave you alone. We're wanting to know more about you. We'd like to know more about our listener base, so we're going to post a survey on our social media. It's going to be a quick poll just to find out more about who you are and who our listener base is. We're going to include in that, optionally, if you want to put your name on that, we are going to have a drawing where we'll give away a piece of True Crimecast merchandise, and we'll let you choose whatever you want from our I guess, library of items available on our Etsy shop or on our Facebook page. So fill that out, and you may get something for free. John, you've taken the lead on this case. I mean, somebody sent this to us a few months ago, and it's kind of been on the back of my mind ever since, but you've taken the lead in the research. So why don't you get us rolling?
Yeah, this is going to be an extremely hard case to get through. We don't like talking about death of children very much, but unfortunately, there's a possibility that we're going to be talking about the death of children. It could be something totally different.
Yeah. So, I thought you were going to say the death of children. I was going to say, or is it?
So it's going to be a little bit of a mystery case today, but we're going back all the way to Christmas Eve, 1945. So let me tell you what happened on that night, and then I'm going to give you a little backstory on this family. So on Christmas Eve, 1945, George and Jeannie Sauter and nine of their 10 children went to bed shortly after midnight. Now, one of their children was not in the home because he was serving in the war and he was out of the house at that time. Jamie, around 1 a.m., there was a fire that broke out. George and Jeannie and four of their children were able to escape, but five of their children were never seen again. I'm going to give you their names and their ages. We have Maurice, who was 14, Martha, who was age 12, Lewis, age 9, Jeannie, and Betty were 5 years old. Let me give you a little backstory on this family. George Sauter was not originally from the U.S. He immigrated to America from Italy in 1895, and he did that when he was 13 years old in 1908. Now, he arrived at Ellis Island with his brother, but his brother immediately returned to Italy, leaving George on his own. So George is over here on his own. He finds some work in the Pennsylvania railroads. He's carrying water and supplies to laborers for a few years. And then he moved to Smithers, West Virginia. Now, it's said from several sources that he was a smart, ambitious man. He worked really hard. He worked as a driver, and he launched his own trucking company, hauling dirt for construction and later freight and coal. One day, as he got a little older, he walked into a local store called the Music Box, and he met the owner's daughter. Her name was Jeannie, who we mentioned before. She had also come over from Italy when she was 3 years old. Jamie, they would get married, and they had 10 children between 1923 and 1943. And they settled in Fayetteville, West Virginia, which is a small town in Appalachia. that was that had a small and active Italian immigrant community. Jamie, it was said that the Sauters were one of the most well-respected middle-class families around that area. George had, it was interesting, I found George would often get in some political conversations about what was going on politically in Italy. And sometimes, I guess those conversations would get a little heated. But yeah, pretty interesting family. Unfortunately, a tragic night happened that evening.
It was. And we're looking at Christmas Eve of 1945. And they had let the kids open some presents. And then they had put the kids to bed. And then George and Jeannie went to bed. And around 12:30 a.m., I guess that's technically Christmas morning, they got a phone call, John. When they answered the phone, there was an unfamiliar female voice that asked for a name of somebody that they didn't know. And when Jeannie had said, that person doesn't live here, there was a lot of laughter that broke out on the other end. It sounded like they heard glass clinking in the background, like somebody was at a party and doing a prank call. Which I guess those things happen occasionally, especially when people had more home phones. You could just go through the phone book and pick a number. So that's easy enough to dismiss if it wasn't for these other circumstances. So when she was going back to bed, she noticed that all the downstairs lights were still on and that the curtains were open. The front door was unlocked. She looked and saw Marion asleep on the sofa in the living room and assumed that all the other kids were upstairs in bed. She went and turned the lights out. She closed the curtains and locked the door and went back to her bedroom. She had just begun to fall asleep when she heard one sharp, loud bang on the roof, and then a rolling noise. Then an hour later, she was awoken again, this time by heavy smoke coming into her bedroom.
So George does what I think any normal man, husband, and father would do. He begins trying everything he can to get his children out of the house. So he... This is hard for me as a dad, man, because I see like his frantic thoughts happening here. So he assesses the scene. He knows that some of his children are out, but he knows that there are five more still inside the house. So George tries to break a window to re-enter the house. He actually does it. He broke the window. He sliced his arm really bad. He doesn't even know at this point that he's sliced his arm open. He's bleeding pretty heavily at this time, but he doesn't even acknowledge the fact that that happened because he's desperately trying to save his children. As you can imagine, this house is filled with smoke. George reports later that as he enters the house, the rooms have already filled with smoke. He can't see anything at that point. So he knew that Martha, Maurice, Lewis, and Jeannie, and Betty were still upstairs, and he assumed they would be cowering in their bedroom at either end of the hallway, which was separated by a staircase. So he kind of imagined them upstairs in their bedrooms, not able to get out. He raced back outside, hoping that he would be able to use a ladder to reach the second floor. Unfortunately, he said that the ladder that he always had beside the house was nowhere to be found, so he's not able to do plan A. So plan B is, I mentioned earlier that he had a trucking business that he would haul coal for, so his next plan was to drive that truck, park it right beside the house, and climb up on top of that truck to gain access into the house. When he got into the truck, the same truck that he had used the day before to do his business that was up and running would no longer start. So he's not able to do either one of the things that he knows he could do to gain access to the second floor. So he begins just trying anything at this point. Like, they had a rain barrel that was next to the house. He tried to scoop water from it, and it was frozen. Jamie, you know, I said at the beginning of this little section here that my heart just breaks for this man as a father. We did a case a few weeks ago where the father... It's a house fire, this particular case too, but the dad is outside and He doesn't seem to be trying as hard as this man to get back into the house. I mean, do you have any thoughts about this so far?
Yeah, this is very different from the other case of Cameron Todd Willingham that we discussed, where that guy was actually put on trial for starting the fire to purposefully kill his family. And he had such erratic behavior outside the home, the neighbors reported him not caring. And that's not the case here with George. George is really trying everything that he can to get to this family that he believes is still inside the house. His daughter Marion sprinted over to a neighbor's house to try to call the Fayetteville Fire Department, but they couldn't get any answer. Another neighbor who saw the fire made a call from a nearby tavern, but again, they couldn't get a hold of the operator there. Exasperated, the neighbor finally drove into town and found the fire chief, who initiated their version of a fire alarm. It was kind of a phone tree system where they would call a firefighter and they would call one and so forth. So the fire department was only 2.5 miles away, but the crew didn't get there, John, till 8 a.m. It started at 1 a.m. It had been burning for 7 hours. And by the time the fire department actually got there, it was really just a smoking pile of ashes. George and Jeannie assumed that 5 of their kids were dead. But when they went to search the home on Christmas Day, there were no traces of their children anywhere. The fire chief I mentioned, his name was F.J. Morris, he said that the blaze may have been hot enough to completely cremate the bodies. A state police inspector would come through and say that it looked like the fire may have been caused by faulty wiring. George had covered the basement with 5 feet of dirt, intending to preserve this site as a memorial to his family. The coroner's office issued 5 death certificates just before they got to the new year, attributing the cause of death to fire or suffocation.
So I didn't put it in that section, Jamie, because I saw a couple of conflicting reports. But he filled up the basement with dirt. Some reports said as early as 5 days after the fire. So that's, in my opinion, that's relatively soon. But he said that he just couldn't stand the sight anymore looking at it. He knew what happened there. So he wanted to preserve it and also make it a memorial garden where he would plant flowers and stuff. So he used his trucks that I mentioned before to bring dirt in and fill those up with dirt. Not advisable by the police, albeit, but yeah.
Yeah, it's almost as if he's making this a burial site and he's burying what he believes are the remains of his children with this dirt.
Yeah, so I just wanted to pick your brain here. You know, I can't imagine losing a child. I can't imagine having to drive by this site and seeing it the way it is and knowing that 5 of my babies had perished in this fire. But for the sake of the investigation and for the, you know, would you fill it in with dirt? Would you do that?
You know, knowing what I know and having looked into things like this, I think you have to let a very thorough investigation take place, not only to find if they were actually cremated. I mean, there are ways that you could probably find that now with the technology we have. But also to make sure what the cause of the fire was. You can't just let a state police inspector come in and say it was probably wiring. Like, you got to know, did somebody set this fire? Was there something I could have done to prevent it? Was it someone else's? Is somebody at fault here, or is it just a horrible accident? So I think you wait until all possibilities have been exhausted before doing something like that. But in 1945, I don't know what kind of possibilities he was going to find.
Right. And it had already been looked at and said that nothing had been found. So I guess at that point in that time, you moved on. So not long after they planted the flowers and filled in that scene with dirt, the Sodders started to wonder if these children were in fact alive. And right after they planted the flowers at the place where the house fire was, they started putting together some odd moments that led up to the fire. And so we're going to talk about some of those. The first one was there was a stranger who appeared at the home a few months earlier, back in the fall, asking about some hauling work with the dad there. He went to the back of the house and while they were talking, pointed to 2 separate fuse boxes and said, "That's going to cause a fire someday." George thought this was strange, but he especially thought it was strange since he had just had the wiring checked by the local power company, which promised it was in fine condition. So why the comments from this man if the power company had just cleared this house saying that the wiring was fine?
Not only why the comments, but that's an odd comment to make. If you want to say, you know, this could cause a fire or this could potentially be dangerous, that's much different than this is going to cause a fire, I think.
And, you know, just to play the devil's advocate here, the guy could have saw something that he thought was suspect and was trying to be friendly and mm-hmm. courteous and say, you know what, you have a problem on your hands, may want to get that looked at. But what George heard was not as helpful and sounded a little more ominous given the fact that his house had burnt down.
And again, we're looking at all these things in retrospect and looking at all these things together when actually they were individual incidents that may create a bigger picture. They may be those individual incidents.
So around the same time, there was another man who came to the house. This guy was looking to sell the family life insurance. And it's reported that this guy just got extremely belligerent and irate when George declined to buy. I'm not going to read his direct quote that George would later repeat, but it was pretty threatening. He said, your house is going to go up in smoke. And he warned that your children are going to be destroyed and you're going to be paid for the dirty remarks you've been making about Mussolini. So I mentioned earlier about the political remarks that George would make. So I guess that guy is referencing those when he becomes upset that George is not buying the insurance money and makes some pretty damning remarks when especially held in the light of what we're talking about in this case. The older Sauter sons recalled something particular. Just before Christmas, they had noticed a man parked along U.S. Highway 21. And the Sauter son said that this guy was intentionally and intently watching the younger kids as they would come home from school. So, yeah, just a series of odd things that they were able to recall after this house fire.
Jeannie really couldn't understand how five children could die in this fire and not leave any kind of evidence, no bone fragments, no flesh of any kind. There was none of their remains to be found. She conducted a private experiment. She burned animal bones, chicken bones, beef joints, pork chop bones, just to see if she could create a fire hot enough that would consume the bones. And each time she tried, she couldn't do it. She was left with charred bones, which is what you would expect to find. She knew of remnants of several different household appliances that had been found in the burned out basement. Those things were not completely burned in the fire, and in fact, they were still identifiable. An employee at a crematorium told her that bones remain after bodies are burned for 2 hours at 2,000 degrees. Their house was entirely destroyed within 45 minutes, John. So it's hard to look here and say that they could have been cremated when there was not the time allotted to do so and probably not enough heat, concentrated heat, to do so. And, you know, there were some other odd moments. I mean, I mentioned the prank call earlier. There was a telephone repairman that had told the Sauters that their lines appeared to have been cut and not burned the night of the fire, which they assumed they had burned up because they were close to the home, but they looked to be cut. They realized that the fire had been electrical, the result of faulty wiring, as the state had told them, then the power would have also been dead. So how do you explain the downstairs rooms that had the lights on while the fire was happening? A witness came forward saying he saw a man at the fire. He was at the scene taking a block and tackle used for removing car engines. So perhaps somebody tampered with George's truck, like you mentioned earlier. They could have also gotten rid of the ladder that you said he couldn't find. And then one day, while the family was visiting the site, Sylvia found a hard rubber object in the yard. And Jeannie had recalled hearing the hard thud from the roof and then something rolling off. George concluded it was kind of like a pineapple bomb, like a pipe bomb that was used in warfare that somebody could have thrown at the house. Maybe it hit the house and started the fire on top, and then they heard that roll off, and she didn't think anything about it as she fell asleep before the fire really grew to a point where you would notice it.
So this next part is probably one of the most bizarre of the case. After they had remembered all these odd things and had recalled some of these odd accounts that they had had with other folks, there began to roll in people calling in to police saying that they actually saw the children alive. So let's go through a couple of those. The first one was from a woman who claimed that she had seen the missing children appearing from a passing car while the fire was in progress. This lady said that she saw the kids looking from a car. I mean, police, of course, were not able to track that down or follow up with that, but it goes on. So another woman reported that she worked in a tourist shop between Fayetteville and Charleston, which is about 50 miles west of where the fire took place. And she said that she saw the children in the morning after the fire. She said that she served them breakfast and noticed that there was a car outside with Florida license plates on it. Now, there was another woman who worked at a Charleston hotel, and she elaborated a little more on what she saw. And if you don't mind, Jamie, I'm going to read some of what she said. She said that she saw the photos of the children in the newspaper and said that she had seen four of the five a week after the fire. She said that the children were accompanied by two women and two men, all of which she thought were Italian. And she made a statement saying she didn't know the exact date. However, the entire party did register at the hotel and stayed in a large room with several beds. They registered around midnight, and she recalled that she tried to talk to some of the kids in a friendly manner, but one of the men appeared hostile and refused to allow the children to talk to her. One of the men, she said, looked at her in a hostile manner before he turned away, and they began talking rapidly in a different language. They reported that they left early the next morning. In 1947, Jamie, this is pretty interesting as well, George and Jeannie sent a letter kind of outlining the case to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and they actually got a reply from J. Edgar Hoover, which, if you're a history buff, that's just kind of phenomenal, right? I mean, he's the man when you talk about FBI, so he personally responded. And unfortunately, he said that this matter is not something that they could personally investigate, that they would have to obtain permission from local police departments before they could come in and assist. But if the local police would grant them the opportunity, they would definitely assist. Well, Jamie, local police refused to allow the FBI to come in and investigate. And so I just wanted to ask you, why do you think that's the case? Why would the police not want the FBI to become involved in this?
I think that's a pretty common thing. I think sometimes police departments get territorial. It happens between city police and county sheriffs. It happens between city police, county sheriffs, and state police and the FBI. Sometimes it's about being territorial, and sometimes it's about just thinking you're right and that you don't need any other assistance. So I think the local police here probably thought this was an open and shut kind of deal, and it would be a waste of resources to call in the FBI. Do you have another theory?
No, I really don't know why the local police wouldn't do it. I mean, I don't know how many instances the FBI would have got involved in these kind of cases. In 1945, the FBI is kind of a new thing. I mean, we don't think of them in 1945 in the same way we do in 2019. I think it's just kind of a territorial issue. I think the police there probably thought that they had done the best they could and did a extensive search to the best of their ability and didn't really think that there was any benefit of other groups coming in. But, yeah, I don't know.
Next, the Sauter family turned to a private investigator, a guy named C.C. Tinsley. So Tinsley started finding things pretty quickly about these series of odd events that happened to the family. For example, the insurance salesman who had threatened George when George declined his offer to sell him some life insurance was also a member of the coroner's jury that deemed the fire accidental. We've talked about a coroner's jury before. It's basically a group of citizens that are selected to make a determination about a crime or about the cause of death or the cause of a fire. before moving into an investigation. It's a very odd thing. I don't know how often it still happens now. Anyway, but the insurance salesman was on the coroner's jury that said that this fire was accidental. He had also heard a curious story from a minister there in Fayetteville about Chief Morris, the fire chief. Although he had told everybody that there were no remains found, he told other people that he had found a heart in the ashes. And that he took that heart, hid it inside of a dynamite box, and buried it at the scene of the crime. Now, that sounds really odd on the surface, John, but Tinsley was able to talk Morris into showing him where he buried this box, and they dug it up. And they took the box to a funeral director, where they pulled out what looked like an organ. They poked and prodded at it, but they concluded that it was a beef liver. So Chief Morris had found a beef liver that was completely untouched by fire and thought it was a human heart and stuck it in a box. Soon after, the Sodders heard rumors that the fire chief had told other people that the contents of the box had not been found at the fire at all. They buried the beef liver at the scene in hope of finding any remains would help the family to grieve and get through it, or it would help the family just to stop asking questions. This whole story of the heart beef liver in a box is just so odd to me. If it was a rumor, that's one thing, but he actually buried a beef liver and tried to pass it off as a heart. What? Why?
I don't know, man. I mean, you got to do the right thing, and if you were to find something like that, you got to turn it over. You got to give that to somebody. I mean, do you think that there's a possibility in 1945 that this was possibly a heart and mistakenly identified as a beef liver? I mean, what do you think?
I don't think so. I think we knew enough about human anatomy to know that a heart from a beef liver, I would imagine a beef liver would be pretty good, I think, or pretty big. I think a human liver is bigger than a human heart, right?
Yeah, I mean, they look totally different. I've seen a beef liver in a store, and I've seen pictures of human hearts. They don't look anything alike. But if they were damaged in a fire, I didn't know if perhaps they could look a little different. I don't know.
Well, I think the funeral director said that it was untouched by the fire, so I don't think that was the case there. It seemed like Chief Morris was just trying to put one over on people, but it seems like a very naive way to do it.
Yeah, I totally don't get his decision to do that at all. So, Jamie, over the next few years, there would continue to be tips and leads that would come in. So I want to go over some of those. There was one time when George saw a newspaper article that had pictures of children in it, and he would swear that those children were his missing children. So he was actually able to track down the family who had these kids in Manhattan. He drove to Manhattan in hopes of seeing the children and talking to the family. But when he got there, the family refused to talk to him. So he wasn't able to follow up on that lead anymore at all. In August 1949, the Sodders decided to mount a new search of the fire scene, and they brought in a Washington, D.C. pathologist named Oscar B. Hunter. So they excavated and did a thorough search. They found several objects. That list includes some damaged coins, a partially burned dictionary, several shards of vertebrae. So that's kind of shocking, right? I mean, they found human vertebrae in the fire scene. So that obviously wasn't found the first time the search was done. So Hunter sent those shards of vertebrae into the Smithsonian Institute to have a detailed analysis done on those. They said that these were human bones. The human bones consist of four lumbar vertebrae belonging to one individual. Since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death would have been about 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should be about 22, and kind of explained scientific reasons for that. They said that normally these vertebrae fuse at 23, but they were still unfused. He went on to say that the bones show greater skeletal maturation than one would expect for a 14-year-old boy, which was the oldest missing Sodder child that died in that fire. So it went on to say that it is, however, possible, although not probable, for a 14-and-a-half-year-old boy to show 16- to 17-year-old vertebrae. So the vertebrae showed no evidence that they had been exposed to fire. the report said, and it went on to say that it is very strange that no other bones were found in the allegedly careful evacuation of the basement of this house. The report noted that the house reportedly burned for only about half an hour or so. It is said that one would expect to find the full skeletal remains of the five children rather than only four small vertebrae. This report concluded that the skeletal remains showed no sign of burns, and that most likely these vertebrae were in the truck that George used to fill in with dirt at the house site.
Let's tackle that from a few angles. First of all, I mean, vertebrae are relatively fragile bone pieces. I would think that if part of your skeleton were to survive a fire, the vertebrae would not be part of it. You have much more dense, thick bones than your vertebrae. Also, they found damaged coins and a partially burned dictionary. So you're telling me part of a book can survive a fire, but not a skeleton. Thirdly, there were vertebrae in this dirt. Where did he get this dirt that there were vertebrae? There's so many pieces to this, so feel free to jump in on any of those.
No, those are all valid questions and all things that I was thinking about when I wrote this outline. The question of where did George get this dirt is a huge question. I mean, I feel like that's a separate crime altogether, right?
Somewhere. It's somebody's bones.
Yeah. But, I mean, the report seems very clear that these vertebrae were not touched by fire. I'd imagine it's pretty easy to spot a vertebrae that had been touched by fire and a vertebrae that hadn't. So it makes sense to me that these bones were not originally in that house, were brought in from somewhere else. But yeah, like you said, a book survived, but all five bodies of these children were not able to be found. So how did those bodies get burnt up so badly, but yet a book survives?
It really doesn't feel very likely, to be honest. The Smithsonian report prompted two hearings that took place at the Capitol there in Charleston in West Virginia. Governor Okey Patterson and the state police superintendent, W.E. Burchett, told the Sodders that their search was hopeless, and they declared the case closed. Undeterred, George and Jeannie erected a billboard along Route 16 and passed out flyers, offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the recovery of their children. They soon increased that amount to $10,000. So they had a billboard with pictures of their kids beside the highway, John, to ask for any help they could get. There was a time when they got a letter from a woman in St. Louis saying that their oldest daughter, Martha, was in a convent there. Another tip came from Texas, where a patron in a bar overheard an incriminating conversation about a Christmas Eve fire that happened in West Virginia. Somebody in Florida reached out to them and claimed the children were staying with a distant relative of Jeannie's. George traveled the country to investigate each and every lead that came in, and he always came home without any answers. John, why do you think so many false tips would be coming in about this case?
Jamie, I mean, this case made national media. I mean, we've seen dozens of other cases where people will send in false tips, will send stuff to the media, just trying to, I don't really know what people get out of it, but they just try to insert themselves in the investigation. I kind of think it's something along those lines. What do you think?
Yeah, there's some of that. Some people just want to be involved in the big story. And I think other people may have genuinely thought that they saw folks that match these descriptions and were trying to help. And I think that happens in any case. We research cases all the time. We've talked to some law enforcement, and they say we get dozens of tips every day. It's just a matter of figuring out which ones are legitimate and worthy of a follow-up. So I think this is probably pretty typical of getting that many tips.
Yeah, there would be one more tip that would come in that I think is noteworthy. In 1968, which would be more than 20 years after the fire, Jeannie would go to the mailbox and find a piece of mail that was addressed only to her. It was postmarked from a town in Kentucky. Now, it had no return address, but inside the envelope there was a photo of a man in his mid-20s, and on the flip side of this photo there was a cryptic handwritten note that read, "Lewis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, little boys, and then it had this series of letters and numbers, A901, 32, or 35. Now, Jeannie said that this man resembled very much Lewis Sauter, who would have been 9 years old at the time of the fire. She said that he had very similarities, which was dark curly hair, dark brown eyes. They had the same straight, strong nose, the same upward tilt to the left eyebrow. So this is pretty interesting that this guy looks remarkably similar to what they remember their 9-year-old looking like in Lewis. Now, they would once again hire a private detective who would go to Kentucky and try to find this man. The Sauters had thought about publishing this letter and this picture in the local newspaper, but when the private detective couldn't find any leads on who this was, they decided not to publish it because they thought it could potentially harm this kid if it was, in fact, Lewis.
Just a year after they received this picture, John, George died. And he was still hoping for a break in the case, but he passed away. Jeannie erected a fence around her property, and she started adding rooms to her home. It was kind of like she was building layer after layer and building space between her and the outside world. Since the fire, she had only worn black clothes as a sign of mourning, and she continued to do so until she died in 1989. That billboard that they had put on Route 16 finally came down. Her children that had survived the fire and were still with them, and grandchildren, continued to investigate the story. They came up with theories of their own, John. Here are some of those. The local mafia had tried to recruit George, and he had declined. So one of the theories is that the mafia tried to extort money from George. He refused, so this was an act of the mafia coming in and setting fire to the home, kidnapping the kids. There's also a theory that the kids were kidnapped by someone that the family knew, someone who had come into the unlocked front door, told them that there was going to be a fire, or that told them about the fire when it first started, and then offered to take them somewhere safe. And then the theory is that maybe they didn't survive that night. If they had, maybe they had lived for decades after. Maybe that really was Lewis in the photo. They failed to contact their parents only because they wanted to protect their parents. So they knew that they could put their parents in danger by reaching out, but maybe they didn't survive. So all these theories are still out there. What do you think of those, or do you have your own?
I don't know, man. It seems far-fetched, right? I mean, it seems unlikely that somebody would come in and kidnap these children. I mean, these kids were supposed to be sleeping on the second floor of the house, so can you realistically sneak into a house, get to the second floor, kidnap 5 children, and get out without alerting anyone else in the house? I mean, that seems, in my house, it seems unlikely. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said. I also find it impossible to believe there were no bones, that there were no remains. And I don't know how to reconcile those two pieces of information.
Yeah, so if you think about it, if these kids were on the second floor of the house, then if in this house fire, if it totally collapsed, you're going to have rubble from the first floor, second floor, and roof. So, you know, you would almost have to excavate this site layer by layer to find these children sandwiched between the rubble. And if you don't do that carefully and meticulously, I think anyone's going to have a hard time finding any remains. But you would think that they would do that piece by piece until they found something. And if we assume that and that is true, then they would have went piece by piece and found no remains whatsoever. We know from other cases that a house fire is not going to be hot enough to completely destroy, bones and all, 5 humans. If we look at, you know, the Tara Grinstead case, the case, gosh, I mean, there's several coming to my mind. You can't physically get a fire hot enough to completely do away with the remains. Even in a crematory, after they professionally burn the bodies, there are still bones left. So I can't buy into the fact that there would not be remains at this house.
Yeah. So this is one of the bigger mysteries of cases that we brought that I feel like we're leaving on a mystery. I don't have a strong inclination of what happened. Because you're right, I can't imagine a scenario where they're able to kidnap five kids from the top floor of a house just before or while setting it on fire. But I have a hard time believing the kids died in the fire. So I don't know what other option there is. These other things that happened around the case, I think if you look at them each in isolation, they don't make any, like, they don't add to the story. The person selling insurance, or the guy who looked and said your house is going to catch on fire because this is bad wiring. I feel like if you separate all those comments, they are insignificant. So that's where I kind of leave all of them. I don't think this was a huge conspiracy of all these different people playing a role and then doing a prank call before they set the house on fire and come in, or doing the prank call to draw them away from their bedroom to go and get the kids. I don't think any of that happened. So I have no strong opinion, and I feel like we're supposed to, so sorry if you wanted me to and I don't.
I mean, we kind of glossed over it, but what about the possibility of the bomb being used? I mean, They found a piece of that. I didn't see anything where they analyzed that to see if it was, in fact, part of a pineapple bomb or, you know. So I think that's interesting. Jeannie said that she heard something hit the roof. It woke her up. She went back to sleep, and an hour later, she woke up again to the smell of smoke. So I would like to know what that was that hit the house. Was it something that fell from a tree? Was it something that was used to help set a house on fire?
The unlikely story we haven't discussed is that, going back to the Cameron Todd Willingham case, George filled that up pretty quickly with dirt afterwards. So were they trying to cover something up as well? Not that they were covering up the bodies of their deceased children, because I don't feel like they would have pushed so hard for the rest of their lives to find them if they had a role in it. But were they trying to hide something as well?
Yeah, I really don't know, man. If I put myself in their shoes, I can't imagine having to look at that site with the possibility of knowing that five of my kids didn't make it out of there. So to clean up that scene as quickly as I could imagine that would make it pretty high up on my priority list. So I don't know. I don't think he was trying to cover up anything. If you look at his behavior on the scene, at the same time, who is there other than family that can verify how he was acting on the scene?
Yeah.
I don't remember any reports of a neighbor being there to see this. So, you know, we're making a lot of assumptions, I guess. But If he acted the way that it was reported that he acted at the scene, this is a guy who is legitimately trying to save his children. I don't know what else he could be trying to hide. I think he was just trying to get rid of this painful reminder of what happened that night.
Occam's razor, the most likely thing happened here is what? That they died in the fire and they were simply unable to find remains? Is that the most likely thing here?
Well, I think part of that is true. I think the most simple solution is that they died in the house fire. But you can't look at that without coming back to there were zero remains found. How is that possible?
I don't know.
So this has been a mystery since 1945, and Jamie, I think this is going to be a mystery until the end of time. I mean, I think that there's potential. I think that if you could track down this kid that sent this picture in and from Kentucky, you know, if you could find this person, you could potentially pull DNA and see if it's a match for his siblings. I think there's some DNA work that could potentially be done in this case, but as it stands right now, I think this is one that goes down in history books as being unsolved. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the only way is if we get in a Bobby Dunbar situation where you do have people come forward and say, no, we are the kids of George and Jeannie, and there is that DNA testing of the grandchildren or the remaining other children. I think that's the only scenario where we find anything out, but I feel like that would have happened before now if it was going to.
Yeah, I mean, if you assume that if they did live and would have lived into an old age, I think it's unlikely that they would have never spoke about it and not spread that word somehow about who they were and who they belonged to.
Yeah, the 14-year-old would be almost 90 by now. So I feel like if they were going to come forward about this, they would have done so already.
So, guys, let us know what you think. You can find us several different ways. You can email us at truecrimecast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram now. All of those, you can find us at True Crime Cast. We're still looking for a few more folks to sign up on Patreon so that we can do our Q&A session with you guys. So please check us out over there. We have the basic package you can get is $3 a month, and that gets you a bonus episode every single month. You can also up that a little bit and get a signed picture of Jamie and I. We have coffee mugs available over there as well, so please check that out.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Please tell your friends, like and share our posts as always. Reviews on Facebook or iTunes are very helpful, probably the most helpful thing you can do for us.
So until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.